It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Central Time, we'll get the latest in national political news from Lisa Hagan of The Hill.
First, the race for the state's top education official concluded yesterday. Incumbent candidate Tody Evers secured his third term as Wisconsin school superintendent and defeated his opponent, Lowell Holtz.
The results were called about a half hour after polls closed. Returns showed around 70% of voters chose Evers. The race was Holtz's second try for the post. He previously ran as a moderate but went for the conservative vote this time around.
In his acceptance speech, Evers called his message one of positivity that resonated better with voters. Holtz congratulated his opponent in his concession, saying that he hoped his campaign, quote, broadened the way people view education reform in Wisconsin.
Peter Goff joins us now to take a closer look at yesterday's results. He's an assistant professor in educational leadership and policy analysis at UW-Madison. Peter, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Kate.
So let's take a look at what tipped the scales here in Evers' favor yesterday.
Well, I think the official turnout was about 16% of eligible voters, and most of those folks are going to be in the education. Teachers are going to have a high proportion there. Act 10 really had took a hard hit on the morale of teachers. So as in Evers' speech, he mentioned this message of positivity, and he's really seen as a champion of teachers supporting what they do, their professionalism, and how they get the job done. So I think that his support of them came through in the polls.
The support of public school teachers.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And this race is officially nonpartisan, but talk about why Evers generally appeals more to Democrats and why Holtz got more support from conservatives.
So Holtz was championing the idea of school vouchers and expanding the school choice program, which is interesting on one hand. That's typically a conservative platform. It's interesting because he also mentioned the achievement gap, and that was a recurring theme and when he was running. But the alignment between the achievement gap and school choice, specifically vouchers and the way they're structured in Wisconsin, isn't particularly well aligned, and that wasn't something that I thought he addressed very well.
But is it surprising that Holtz's message about school choice didn't resonate a bit better with Wisconsin voters, because here President Trump, a supporter of school choice and who opposed Common Core, he won Wisconsin.
That's true. I think it would be easy to cast the message that the superintendent turnout was against school choice, but I'm not entirely convinced that that's what it is. We already have a fairly robust and expanding school voucher program, and who ends up in the superintendency isn't going to do much to change that. We'll change sort of how that's implemented and how it's done, but the system's already in place.
And Holtz did win 30% of the vote. What does that message send to us?
He did win 30% of the vote. It's a resounding minority, and it's the Evers' largest margin in the last three elections. So I think it really says that the Evers' message is for the people that are voting for superintendent. His message seems to be coming through loud and clear.
And he was the center. Holtz was the center of a controversy. This was heading into the primary about this thing with John Humphreys that became public, the proposal for that, you know, the winning candidate would hire the other in this job and get a driver. Do you think that impacted how he was chosen by voters or seen by voters?
It definitely shaped my perception of the election. I don't know broadly sort of what the polls say, but it was well publicized. It was definitely unflattering. And I think when we think of the conservative platform, we're worried about big business and sort of the collusion that happens behind the scenes. And if he was seen to be part of that, that's something that voters are going to move away from.
In the final days of the race, the state's achievement gap was front and center in the conversation. Can you give us an overview of how Wisconsin is comparing to other states in achievement?
Sure. When we look at the NAEP, the large-scale national assessment, the black-white achievement gap, Wisconsin tends to come in last, has the largest black-white achievement gap in the country. It's nothing new. We've been in last place for quite a long time. It's a systemic problem. It's something that I think Holtz mentioned that Evers has been complacent on, even though if you look back at sort of Evers' policies and even his fair funding proposals are really aimed at sort of reforming the way we think about education and trying to get dollars into the schools to remediate that specific problem.
It's hard to move the needle fast, though.
It is. Education has been expanding, over the last 100 plus years, from the one-room schoolhouse to incorporate more and more and more of sort of the social remediation that comes along with poverty. And obviously, race and poverty are distinct, but they overlap sometimes. And absolutely, those are tough problems to solve.
We're talking with Peter Goff right now. He's an assistant professor in educational leadership and policy analysis at UW-Madison. We're talking about recapping here the state superintendent race last night. Tony Evers, decisive victory over Lowell Holtz for state superintendent of public instruction. And how did Evers address this achievement gap issue? Because it's a tough question, and it can be a very complex answer, I would imagine.
We've seen Evers, in my mind, we've seen Evers push more and more and more for school funding reform. We have a system in Wisconsin right now where we have more money that got pushed into education lately, which was great. But it's not necessarily going in the most efficient, in my estimation, in the most efficient direction, although all dollars are well appreciated. But they're not the ways that are going to really move the needle on the achievement gap specifically.
And in this budget, Governor Scott Walker proposed spending $649 million on K-12 education in the next 2 years. What do you think that says about how Evers will work with other lawmakers at the Capitol?
I think it bodes well insofar as Evers advocated strongly for more money for rural schools, and that's what we saw in the budget. There are other aspects of the budget, sort of the flat element, the sort of the tack-on, which is the least effective way and sort of the most regressive way to address the achievement gap. So I think there's still a sizable amount of work to be done there.
Well, explain that flat tack-on, if you will, and the equal spending among each child that is the proposal.
Sure. That's what Walker put into place was a good chunk of that money was equal dollars for equal students, meaning that All students will receive an equal boost, regardless of their level of challenge or adversity. And that's really not the way we want to solve the achievement gap. The students that are encountering the greatest adversity, we want to make sure they have the most resources to overcome those.
Do you think Evers will push back on that?
I think he'll continue to advocate for funding systems that will channel money where the least advantaged students need it the most.
And so looking ahead here, election behind us, third term coming up, what do you think Tony Evers' first order of business will be in his third term? What's he rolling up his sleeves over?
Dr. Evers has been very proactive on the teacher staffing challenges around the state. Act 10, as I mentioned, has had a sizable morale hit to teachers, and there is some worry about the supply across various locales, across the different content areas. So making sure that we can get teachers into the profession, making sure we can get them into the classroom, and then making sure we can keep them in the classroom is a major priority.
How big of an issue is that?
That's something that we're looking at right now. We will have a series of studies coming out late spring, early summer that address that exact point. But it's a complex and pretty nuanced topic that lies at the intersection of kind of the demand for teachers as well as the supply of teachers and how those two fit together.
Peter, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Peter Goff. He's assistant professor in educational leadership and policy analysis at UW-Madison. He joined us to recap Tony Evers' decisive victory over Lowell Holtz for state superintendent of public instruction.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Coming up, we'll learn about a program that brings together pregnant mothers in Racine in an effort to deliver healthier babies.
Right now, it's time for our weekly check-in on the latest in national politics. Just this morning, President Trump's controversial National Security Advisor, Stephen Bannon, was removed from his position on the National Security Council, and we'll talk about what that could signal.
Plus, we'll take a look at some high-profile political races in the country and how their outcomes could shape politics on Capitol Hill, and much more.
Lisa Hagen joins us now. She is a political reporter for The Hill, where she focuses on political campaigns. Lisa, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with this news about Stephen Bannon. He has been Trump's chief strategist and also held a seat on the National Security Council as of this morning. He is out of that position, and some new figures who had previously been on are back, including the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. What can you tell us about this move?
Right. Well, Steve Bannon, he's White House chief strategist, so, you know, it was a big deal when news broke that he was going to be removed from the National Security Council. And it's a big development because Bannon's role on the NSC was criticized by many people on both sides of the aisle as, you know, Trump trying to politicize the council. So National Security Advisor McMaster, he made the decision, and it was approved by Trump. So this can kind of be seen as McMaster, you know, regaining some authority and trying to shift things from his predecessor, Michael Flynn, who was recently ousted from the National Security Advisor position.
Is this being seen as a kind of demotion for Stephen Bannon, or just that, as you said, McMaster is starting to shape his own position?
Right. Well, at least the White House is insisting that it's not a demotion for Bannon. He's a very trusted advisor of Trump. He came on to his campaign in the final months, and, you know, a lot of people credit him with Trump's victory, and also had an influential role in Breitbart News. So, you know, White House says this is not a demotion, but in the new capacity of the NSC, Bannon can still be invited to meetings. He still has his national security clearance, according to Bloomberg, he is going to continue to attend meetings, and apparently is going to be in one this afternoon. So White House is definitely trying to signal that that is not the case.
And Stephen Bannon, again, off the National Security Council, at least in that official capacity. As you said, he can be invited back. But can you tell us who in turn is stepping up and will be in regular rotation there?
Yeah, so McMaster definitely has more of a role there. They are also restoring the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, also director of National Intelligence. So a lot of these people are going to be having roles on the principal committees and are going to be in regular attendance of in meetings. So that they will be kind of the big players. But it seems like, at least as of right now, Bannon will still have somewhat of a role and will kind of be looming over it. But it seems like he'll have a pretty hands-off role going forward.
How is this news being digested in Washington in terms of what the move could mean for national security policy going forward?
Right. So far, it seems like it's being applauded from both sides of the aisle. It seems like it's welcome news on Capitol Hill. John McCain, Republican senator, you know, had sent out a statement applauding the administration for doing that, as well as a few other Republican lawmakers. And of course, Democratic lawmakers are also excited to hear about the news, because it really was viewed by many as Trump trying to politicize everything. So by having Bannon taken out, people see this as the NSC being kind of restored to its normal order.
And were there some, to put it one way, ruffled feathers, you know, that some figures who had been on the Security Council, including the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, was previously off? Are relationships like that perhaps going to be restored?
Yeah, it's still too early to tell. Everything kind of just the shakeup has happened now, but it seems like they want to kind of give the control back to McMaster. You know, the whole reason why Bannon said that he was on this was to downsize the NSC from where Obama's administration had it. So he wanted to oversee what the ousted National Security Advisor Michael Flynn was doing and seeing that downsize. But it seems like Bannon and Trump in the White House trust McMaster. So I'm sure with, you know, the coming changes, you know, a lot of the tensions might die down and things will kind of go back to its normal order.
Now, moving on to a different area, a lot of politics watchers have been keeping an eye on various races across the country as sort of a litmus test for Democrats engaging the measure of anti-Trump backlash. And one of these races is a House seat in Georgia. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so Democrats are really excited about this race. They've all rallied around this young rising star. He's 30 years old. His name is John Ossoff. And based on how things have been going in the final weeks, I think Democrats really see victory in the realm of possibility. It's a House seat in Georgia. It is a typically conservative district, but President Trump did only win it by 1 point in the 2016 election. So Democrats see this as a viable option, and they're really hoping that on April 10th, when that's the primary, they're hoping Ossoff can get 50% of the vote, and that would be to avoid a runoff. So if come April 18th, no one gets that majority of the vote, the top two finishers will go off to a runoff in June. But Democrats are really betting big on this race.
And it sounds like it's kind of an unusual race. The field is especially crowded, apparently, with Republicans, and that could, it seems like, benefit Ossoff.
Yeah, exactly. It's 18 candidates. They're all able to run in the same primary, the jungle primary. But, yeah, there's 11 Republicans, so they're all trying to, you know, carve out some room in this really crowded race, especially because John Ossoff, the Democrat, is getting a lot of attention. So I think Republicans are worried that this many candidates dilutes the race, and that kind of props up Ossoff to get that 50%. But again, it's a really tough feat. Getting 50% of the vote with 18 candidates is really tough. But having all these Republicans definitely makes it seem at least a little bit more realistic.
And if Ossoff wins, obviously not a foregone conclusion, but if he does win, what sorts of things might people read into that?
Well, at least, as you said, you know, Democrats are trying to use it as a litmus test. This is, you know, we're seeing some special elections, so this is the first real competitive race since, you know, Donald Trump took office. So they, you know, if Ossoff can win, especially outright in the April 18th primary, I think Democrats are going to look at that as an early indicator for what's to come in 2018 and what we can see, you know, happening around the country. So, you know, we're seeing Democrats everywhere kind of pile in resources and send staffers and volunteers down to Georgia. So, you know, if they can really mobilize voters to come out, especially in these low turnout special elections, I think they're going to point to that as reasons why they, you know, can win in 2018 and maybe put, you know, the House and, you know, a little bit more unrealistically, but the Senate into play.
And are Republicans also funneling resources into that particular race?
Yeah. So we're seeing, I mean, Republican candidates are ramping up and they're, you know, putting out a lot of TV ads. But one notable player is the Conservative Club for Growth. They're going in pretty big for one of the candidates, Bob Gray, and they're, instead of just focusing on Ossoff, which a lot of the Republicans have done, they're taking aim at Karen Handel, who's a former Georgia Secretary of State, and she's previously run for political office before, so they're trying to tie her, you know, label her as, you know, a longtime career politician. So definitely trying to have that little narrative, the outsider versus the insider candidate.
We're talking with Lisa Hagan right now, political reporter for The Hill with a focus on political campaigns as we do our weekly check-in on Washington. And there have been a couple of other races that are remarkable, I guess, in that they have some big names associated with the candidates. Bernie Sanders supporting a candidate in, help me out here, Virginia.
In Virginia.
Mm-hmm. Right. And Elizabeth Warren, a candidate in California. So what's happening with those races?
Yeah, so we're seeing a lot of these progressive icons, you know, Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, getting in early for these candidates. I mean, in 2016, these were two coveted endorsements, and they, you know, they only did endorsements, you know, pretty infrequently. So the fact that, you know, Sanders is willing to go in big for Tom Perriello in the Democratic primary for the Virginia governor's race, that's a big deal. He's trying, you know, this race in Virginia, the Democrats are trying to, you know, be the more progressive candidate. So Perriello's tried to, you know, carve out his name and go down that lane. So he's a former congressman, and since he's jumped into the race, he's centered his campaign around anti-Trump rhetoric. So that kind of goes hand in hand with Bernie Sanders' approach. So we'll see, you know, how he continues to mold that message, especially tomorrow, because Sanders will be going out and campaigning with Perriello on the campaign trail.
And shifting gears a little as we wrap up, President Trump has said throughout his campaign that he would not plan on taking a salary if he was elected. And this week he kept that promise. So tell us about where Donald Trump put part of his paycheck.
Yeah, so White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer, he announced on Monday that Trump will donate his first 3 months of salary, so that's his first quarter salary, and donate the whole thing, which is about a little over $78,000. So he's giving that to the National Park Service, and Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke was also at the press briefing, so he said the money will go to improving the country's historic battlegrounds. So, I mean, it's a campaign promise and a promise he made after being elected, and he's following through. But he's definitely taking a little bit of heat from his critics, who are just chalking it up to and calling it a publicity stunt.
And today it sounds as though the amount of that check was sort of cast in contrast against the amount that could be cut from the Park Service. Has that been commented on much?
Yeah, so the group, the environmental group, Sierra Club, the one that called it a publicity stunt, that they're saying that making the argument, if Trump really wants to help out, preserve parks, that the budget proposals would just slash the budget of all these agencies, especially Interior Department being able to do that. So while, the donation is probably a welcomed one, it really wouldn't balance out with the type of cuts he's proposing.
And based on what you've seen with the president donating his salary to various causes, is this something that will be something that we can expect to see regularly and be a bit of a media event as well, seeing, the question, where will that paycheck go this time?
Yeah, I think so, especially as we see, kind of chaotic times and controversies in the, the Trump administration, having Sean Spicer start the press conference with that salary and a chance for a photo op. I'm sure we'll see more of that. So, and in an earlier press briefing, Spicer had said that Trump would, he originally said that Trump would donate his entire salary at the end of the year. So I'm sure we'll see, more of where his salary, the rest of his salary for the year is going to go. And I'm sure there'll be scrutiny on President Trump, given the fact that there have been media reports that he was supposed to donate to something, and a lot of those charities hadn't seen anything. So I'm sure there will be reporters following up on that pretty closely.
Lisa, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
That was Lisa Hagan, political reporter for The Hill, and she joined us to give us the latest in national politics.
Coming up after the news, Wisconsin has one of the worst infant mortality rates in the nation. We'll learn about a Racine program that's bringing pregnant mothers together to support each other to get healthier outcomes for infants. I'm Kate Archer Kent.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Kate Archer Kent. Coming up, Senator Van Wongaard joins us to talk about a bill he co-authored that would eliminate the social host loophole in Wisconsin, which lets adults serve alcohol to minors in their homes.
First, Wisconsin has some of the worst racial disparities in the nation when it comes to infant mortality. And this racial gap continues to puzzle Wisconsin researchers. An African-American infant is 3 times more likely to die in the first year of life than a white infant.
A program in Racine is trying to turn this around and reduce the number of black infants who die before they turn 1. The founders of the Greater Racine Collaborative for Healthy Birth Outcomes join us now. Dr. Teresa Johnson is an associate professor of nursing at UW-Milwaukee and a research nurse consultant at Ascension All Saints Hospital in Racine. Teresa, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And Margaret Melnori is Administrative Director for Women's and Children's Services at Ascension All Saints. Margaret, welcome to you.
Thank you as well.
Teresa, let's begin with you. Help us understand infant mortality in Wisconsin and what is going on with African-American births here.
One of the important things to think about is with our infant mortality overall, we don't look that bad. It's 5.7 deaths per 1,000 births in Wisconsin and 5.8 for the U.S. But what's so very different is, especially in southeast Wisconsin and in Racine specifically, that's where we see the rate 3 times higher for the black infants than the white infants. So all of those infant who is born black has three times the risk of dying before the first birthday than a white baby.
So what do you think is going on there, Teresa? Why is this happening?
There's several different reasons. First off, we have the social determinants of health. And I know a lot of public health people aren't used to that particular terminology, so I'll explain some of those. Examples include economic stability, so poverty, how many individuals in the household are working full-time. Education is another one of those. And for education, it includes birth to three, how children are read to as babies on up, how many go to college right after high school, and also how many individuals graduate in 4 years from high school. Then the third one is, of those social determinants, is health and health care, which includes insurance and interactions with health care providers. So are individuals able to get the appropriate medical, health, and dental care in a timely manner? A fourth is neighborhood and built environment. So are they in environments that there's a lot of violence? Mm. Are there issues with air quality and then lead?
Mm. Yeah.
And then
go ahead.
And the last one is the social and community contact. So looking at people who are registered voters, and if a family member or parent has spent time in jail or prison. So you can tell that that's a wide variety of issues surrounding a family that can potentially impact their reproductive health and their birth outcomes.
Mm. But that really doesn't address the issue of the racial disparity. That could be for anybody. So if you're really talking about why African Americans have this problem, it really boils down to racism. Racism in America. Because if you look at African Americans or black people in their native country, they do not have a racial disparity for infant mortality. It comes down to racism, pure and simple. And if we think racism isn't alive and well, I can give you a recent example. My husband is a high school teacher in a Milwaukee school, and one of his friends, coworkers, walks the track every morning. And a woman came up to this man a couple weeks ago, so it's very recent, and said, "Do you work here?" And he said, "Yes, I do." And there was some noise going on in another room. And she said, "Well, then you must be the janitor, so you can go fix that noise for me." No, he's the lead guidance counselor in the school. Again, a very easy mistake that we take for granted that African-American people put up with day in and day out as they go about their lives.
So, Margaret, you and Teresa are really trying to address this disparity through the Greater Racine Collaborative for Healthy Birth Outcomes. Tell us what you're doing through this program.
Well, we started this work in 2006-07, where Teresa and I, along with a public health nurse, really identified that we had a huge issue with infant mortality, particularly among African Americans in our community. This has been a long process, so it takes 10 years to really see outcomes that we're seeing now, and it takes the whole community to come together to work on this. We had over 100 agencies working with us since 2006 to identify what we needed to do. We really formed this collaborative, and we did a lot of groundwork to identify how we wanted to proceed. We did some strategic planning. We came up with priorities, and our first priority was to improve the health and safety of African American women and their families over their entire lifespan. So
I want to point out an intervention before we go any further along those lines that we really began with during those early days and early years, and that includes educating our community on the impact of racism. Because some people will say, well, it's 2017, there's no racism. Well, yes, there is. And it's hard for individuals to understand what it's like to have somebody follow them through a department store waiting on them to shoplift because of their color, and that individual makes a whole lot more than most of us do. So just based on their color, that stress of racism and stress of going through their life, having somebody watching them every single minute.
And so, Teresa, I'm going to step in there because I really want to get to the program here, the Centering Pregnancy Program. Can you tell us what you're trying to do with that and how it's going?
Well, we can talk about Centering Pregnancy is a national program that was started in 1993 to 1994 by a nurse midwife in Connecticut. And this program really is a group model of prenatal care that integrates three major components of care: health assessment, education, and support. So that's, it's like receiving your prenatal care in a group versus going to your doctor or nurse practitioner or nurse midwife one-on-one. And let me give you an example of what happened. The first group we started was in 2012. And there was much discussion before we started these groups about, do we want to have the groups just women who've had other babies, just young teens? Do we want to have separate types of group? The centering model of pregnancy really talks about anyone belongs in the group at any time. The discriminating factor is when is your due date, so that we have people who are all due about the same time. In one of the very first groups, there was a young girl who was 15. And everybody was like, ooh, how is this going to work? Well, she was 15. She and her boyfriend rode their bikes to every group centering opportunity. They chose then to give up their baby for adoption. And one of the things of centering is after all the women deliver, they come back and have a final kind of group party and show everybody their babies and all the fun stuff that goes with it. Well, the adoptive couple in Milwaukee chose to bring this baby down so that they could have their baby in the group setting with all the rest of their friends they had made and who had supported this young 15-year-old couple throughout their pregnancy. That never would happen if the young girl had just gone to her provider on a one-to-one visit.
We're talking right now with Dr. Teresa Johnson, an associate professor of nursing at UW-Milwaukee, and she's a research nurse consultant at Ascension All Saints Hospital in Racine, and Margaret Malnori, who is administrative director for Women's and Children's Services at Ascension All Saints. And together they are working to address the infant mortality issue here in Wisconsin and have programs that they're addressing right there in Racine. And Margaret, with the Centering Pregnancy Program, you know, pregnancy can be very scary, a very uncertain time. What is it about this program? Does it give the support system that's been needed? What is the magic of the program?
I think there's two magic pieces to it. I believe support is integral because you have the support of your physician. Our groups are all led by physicians, which is unique in Racine. Typically, most programs are run by nurse midwives. So that's a leap of faith that our physicians took to facilitate these groups. So think of it. When you have a typical prenatal visit, you have maybe 10 minutes with your physician or provider. In centering, you have 2 hours where you interact with this person and among the other group members. So support from the group members and support from your provider is integral to the success of it. But also the education. There's a very structured education program that goes with it. This is a national model. You have to follow the prescribed curriculum. So at 20 weeks, your topic is X, and at 25 weeks, your topic is Y. And those topics are educational. They promote a lot of group discussion. So Mom A may say, well, the last time I was pregnant, I didn't know that I was supposed to do this. And the first time Mom will go, oh, thanks for letting me know. So there's a lot of group interaction as well as the education and support.
Teresa, do you track then these babies and these moms after birth and for how long?
Yes, we do. And actually, the kind of tracking that we do is just while they're in the hospital. Some of the information we do have for some of the preterm infants. But the long-term, the infant mortality component of this is actually conducted through the Central Racine Health Department, and they provide us with those statistics, as well as the state of Wisconsin. So most of what we have is all of the information about their pregnancy and then all of the information about their inpatient hospitalization for both the mother and the baby.
If you look at centering nationwide, the two major outcomes that centering has influence on is decreasing the prematurity rate, which we know prematurity is the lead indicator for fetal and infant mortality,
mm-hmm.
and then increasing breastfeeding on discharge. So those are definitely two of the indicators that we track when comparing our centering program with other programs.
We're talking right now with Teresa Johnson, an associate professor of nursing at UW-Milwaukee, and Margaret Milnori, administrative director for Women's and Children's Services at Ascension All Saints Hospital, about the racial gap in infant mortality and what's being done about it in Wisconsin.
And you can join the discussion at 800-642-1234. Were you involved in a centering pregnancy group, and what was your experience like? Did you have access to another type of support system that may have helped during pregnancy? And if you are in healthcare and you work with mothers and infants, we want to hear what you think about the infant mortality issue in Wisconsin. Join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up this conversation after a short break. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Right now, we're continuing our conversation with Teresa Johnson, a nursing professor at UW-Milwaukee, and Margaret Milnori, administrative director for Women's and Children's Services at Ascension All Saints in Racine. Together, they started the Greater Racine Collaborative for Healthy Birth Outcomes. We're talking about a national program that's helped reduce infant mortality in Racine and the racial divide that exists. An African-American infant is three times more likely to die in the first year of life than a white infant.
And we want to hear from you on this issue at 800-642-1234. What things should Wisconsin do to help solve this infant mortality problem? What questions do you have about programs that could help reduce the number of infant deaths? And if you work in healthcare and among women and infants, how have you tried to address this infant mortality problem? And is it working? Join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And let's go right away to the calls. Let's go to Betty in Madison. Hi, Betty.
Hi. So I'm just calling because I am currently pregnant. And I went to one meeting of a centering pregnancy group here in Madison. And I can understand how the benefits that you're talking about can be seen, but my experience was largely negative. I walked into a room with a bunch of people that I didn't know, with someone who wasn't my doctor, and didn't know exactly what we were doing or what was going on. And I could hear, you know, other patients' discussions with the provider because it wasn't private. They were just behind a curtain, basically. So I guess my concern with the centering pregnancy is that, you know, in an environment like that, perhaps people wouldn't be as open about concerns that they're having or be receiving, you know, the specialized attention that you would in a one-on-one setting. So it might have benefits in certain situations, but not in all of them.
Teresa, do you want to approach that?
I do. One of the things about any time you begin a new group is you have to give them a chance. And in the groups that we run here, we have some of our staff that are absolutely wonderful about developing activities that help this group to get to know each other. And I understand that your concern, too, about what's private and what's not. But if there's more time needed or other questions that need to be asked, those times can be made available. And if there's things that you're not comfortable sharing, you don't. But then as the group comes together, there's trust built amongst the members of the group, and what's talked about there stays there. And a lot of the women have really benefited from their contact and experiences of other women. But if they didn't go past the first group, they might have voiced similar concerns that you did.
Hey, Betty, did you stick with it?
No, I immediately told my provider that I didn't feel comfortable in that setting. And I guess that could have been largely based on the facilitators of that specific group,
mm-hmm.
and how they handled, you know, that there were no introductions or anything like that when we first walked in. So I understand that it is a very individual reaction to different types of care. I would just hope that in the research that they're doing about the efficacy of these groups, that they're also exploring the possibility, you know, of negative reactions like that and what effects that might have on outcomes as well.
Well, Betty, thank you so much for calling in and telling us your story about that. We really appreciate it. Let's now go to Fawn in Madison. Hi, Fawn.
Hi. I'm so glad you're having this topic. And I would like to tell you, I'm an adoptee myself, and I'm a biracial woman who is adopted at birth to a white couple, well, mixed, multicultural couple. I had a wonderful upbringing, so I had a positive experience with adoption. I am more recently located my birth mother. We have a fabulous relationship. It's just wonderful. And I'd like to talk to the story that you told about the adoptive parents bringing the baby to the centering group. Just brought tears to my eyes. It's so touching. Thank you for sharing that. It just underscores how supportive that group can be and how tight-knit, close-knit, and how much it means to the people who are in the group. I'd also like to thank you for carrying on that program. It's so valuable, and it's so such an important topic and such an important issue. And not only that is the centering pregnancy, the program itself, I'm sure, very valuable, but also that you highlighted the responsibility or the part that every Wisconsinite plays. All white Wisconsinites really are a part of the solution by learning more about racism and by examining our behavior and what I say are because I'm biracial. I have full inclusion. But for all people can be more aware of the effects that our actions have on other people, particularly minorities, particularly people of color. And that will have an impact on infant mortality, believe it or not. I really appreciate you bringing that up. Thank you.
And Fawn, thank you so much for calling in. Margaret, with Fawn there and addressing that support that she received in her upbringing, how big of an issue is support and having the need your needs met in getting a baby to their first birthday?
Support is very, very critical. As we know, as Teresa talked about, the increased stress if you don't have support. If you don't have the support of your community, if you don't have your support in your neighborhood, if you don't have support in your health care, it all adds increased stress. And we know that stress increases the cortisol level in the mom, which then can negatively impact the fetus, which could have an impact on the infant mortality rate.
And can I also point out that that stress continues not just through that time during pregnancy in the child's life, but also increases their risk for other chronic illnesses throughout the lifespan. So that experience that that woman and that fetus and child have gone through as a result of stress during pregnancy in her life contribute to increased risk for heart disease, hypertension, cancers, and other kinds of illnesses that continue through the lifespan.
And we know that that is passed generation to generation because, as I said previously, minorities who are in their native country do not have the same issue with infant mortality as minorities in America, but it doesn't happen the first generation typically. It happens second and third generation, so it stresses a huge issue to the minorities who have immigrated into our country.
Well, before we wrap up, I want both of you to take a moment here and talk about what has been the toughest challenge you've been working on here through this issue of infant mortality, and what have been your milestones, your little aha moments. Teresa, let's begin with you.
I'm going to say educating the community about racism, because so many people think, well, I'm a good person. I treat everybody the same. And through a lot of this work, a lot of individuals that I've had contact with have come to acknowledge, oh, yes, there I saw it, there I saw it. And until we take it and own it and realize that there are certain privileges sometimes people have because they're white, even though that's not right, we're not going to fix it. So
really quickly here, we're running out of time.
Okay, so that's my biggest takeaway.
I think one of the biggest.
Okay, I gotta jump in here. Teresa Johnson is an associate professor of nursing at UW-Milwaukee. Margaret Melnori is an administrative director for Women's and Children's Services at Ascension All Saints in Racine. Together, they founded the Greater Racine Collaborative for Healthy Birth Outcomes to address the racial gap that exists in infant mortality rates and to help more babies reach their first birthday.
And remember, you can chime in. Let us hear your story and what you think about the conversation you just heard, what it brought up for you on our Central Time Facebook page. The door is always open, and you can keep that conversation flowing over there. Today is National Walking Day. The American Heart Association sponsors the day to remind people about the health benefits of taking a good old-fashioned walk.
And today is a little gray and wet and drab, but you could pull on something waterproof and brave the weather. If it's okay for ducks, I think we can handle it.
It's interesting that today is also Deep Dish Pizza Day in contrast with National Walking Day. But if you have had a slice or two or three of Deep Dish Pizza, Wisconsin has more than 2,730 miles of hiking trails. So we've got a lot of resources for our walks here in Wisconsin.
And I am really wanting to know more about the Ice Age Trail. It sounds absolutely spectacular. I understand it's eventually going to be a 1,000-mile trail, and that's a very long way, and you can burn off a ton of that deep dish pizza.
You need a few National Walking Days or a month of National Walking Days. Well, that's a great one, Kate. And one of my favorites is along the dunes in Kohler Andre State Park along Lake Michigan there.
Yeah.
If you haven't been there yet, it's so beautiful in the summer, probably in a lot of seasons. I tend to go there in the summer. But so maybe a little bit gray today, but might as well try it. Get out there and take a walk.
Take a stroll.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.